Imagine hiring like a temporary worker just to keep your business alive during a crisis, right?
Hoi!
And then only to discover that simply signing their paycheck just legally obligated you to pay two full workforces for the next decade.
Yeah, which is just a total nightmare scenario.
It really is. Well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're opening up this fascinating operational playbook. And a service breakdown from Regional Supplemental Services, or RSS Inc.
Yeah, they're a contingency staffing firm, right?
Exactly. And their playbook details this massive, basically hidden iceberg of logistics, legalities, and risks that are involved in deploying replacement drivers during a labor strike.
And, the document is just entirely focused on that invisible machinery of crisis management. It really forces you to look at the incredibly complex threads that keep supply chains moving when standard operating procedures just completely break down.
Yeah, but before we get into the weeds here, we really need to set some parameters for this deep dive because, labor strikes are highly sensitive.
Very much so.
They're politically charged events, they involve deep human elements, people's livelihoods, and frankly, complex histories on both sides of the picket line.
Absolutely.
So, for our purposes today, we are strictly analyzing the business, logistical, and legal mechanics exactly as they're presented in this source material.
Right, just looking at the mechanics.
Yeah. We aren't taking sides. We aren't endorsing any viewpoints regarding unions or management. We're simply examining the machinery of how an organization attempts to keep things moving when the normal system stops.
And that machinery is fascinating because it touches like every single nerve of an organization simultaneously. You're watching legal, human resources, operations, and risk management all just collide in real time under extreme pressure.
Yeah, and whether you are a manager playing for business continuity or just someone who's, fascinated by how incredibly fragile our systems actually are, this breakdown reveals that there is really no such thing as a simple operational swap.
No, definitely not.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the initial instinct for a manager who's facing a driver shortage is purely operational, right? You have an empty truck, you need a body with a commercial driver's license in the seat. Simple. So why does a company need to bring in labor council before a strike even happens? I mean, a truck is a truck and a strike is a strike.
Well, what's fascinating here is that the law actually does not view all strikes equally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The legal framework in the United States categorizes labor disruptions, and that categorization dictates the entire battle plan. Like the most fundamental distinction you must make is whether you're dealing with an economic strike or an unfair labor practice strike.
That sounds like a really subtle labeling difference. Why does the origin of the strike change the actual logistical response on the ground?
Because it changes literally everything about who you are legally allowed to hire and how you deploy them. So in an economic strike, which is typically, a dispute over wages, benefits, working conditions, employers generally have the right to hire temporary and crucially permanent replacement workers to keep the business running.
Okay.
But if the union alleges the company violated labor laws, it becomes classified as an unfair labor practice strike. And in that scenario, the rules completely flip.
Okay, so assume a company guesses wrong. Like, they assume it's just a standard dispute over hourly wages. They panic about keeping their supply chain moving, and they just go ahead and hire permanent replacements. What is the actual penalty when the dust settles?
Oh, well, you're looking at a complete structural collapse of your workforce model.
A structural collapse.
Basically, yeah. Because striking workers in an unfair labor practice strike generally retain the right to immediate reinstatement. That is, once they unconditionally offer to return to work.
Right.
So if you've already permanently replaced them, you've just created this massive self-inflicted liability. You could be legally forced to reinstate the striking workers right alongside the permanent replacements.
Oh, man. So suddenly you have two full workforces on your payroll.
Exactly. Two workforces, enormous back pay liabilities, and just a legal nightmare that could cripple the company's finances for years.
That is wild. It's less like swapping out a broken engine part and much more like a complex organ transplant. Like, the company is the body, the replacement workforce is the new organ, and the legal framework is the immune system.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Right, because if you just jam the new organ in without precisely managing the legal immunosuppressants, the entire system actively rejects it and attacks itself.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. You really need the legal architecture fully established before you even attempt the transplant. Which, brings us to the reality of actually sourcing these highly specialized drivers.
Right, where do they come from?
Well, the playbook makes it abundantly clear. Reacting after a strike goes public is a guaranteed failing strategy.
Okay, let me challenge that timeline, though. If a company knows a contract is expiring, why can't they just, you know, quietly prepare an advertising campaign and launch it the morning a walkout happens?
Because time is the one asset you literally cannot buy back in a logistics crisis. Think about the mechanics of the labor pool in a specific region.
Okay.
The moment a strike hits the news, the available pool of qualified commercial drivers shrinks exponentially.
Why is that?
First, you have a significant percentage of drivers who will simply refuse to cross an active picket line, either out of principle or, frankly, safety concerns.
Sure, that makes sense.
And second, your competitors know you're compromised.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they're going to aggressively scoop up the remaining independent capacity to secure their own supply lines.
So the pool just evaporates instantly. Where do the prepared companies actually find these drivers then, if the standard job boards are basically useless?
They utilize multiple pre-vetted channels simultaneously. Specialized contingency staffing firms like RSS Inc. are usually the primary lifeline.
Right, the specialists.
Exactly. But they also tap into independent contractor networks. They leverage third-party logistics providers, often called 3PLs, that might have sudden overflow capacity. And in some specific jurisdictions, they even mobilize retired or inactive drivers whose commercial licenses are still valid.
Wow, dragging people out of retirement. So getting legal clearance is the first hurdle. Finding the actual humans to drive the trucks is the second. But transitioning from the boardroom to the balance sheet here, the immediate shock for any manager looking at this playbook has to be the cost.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the source material states that replacement drivers command premium rates of 1.5 to 3 times the baseline hourly rate.
Yeah, it's not cheap.
But wait, if I'm looking at a spreadsheet, a 3x multiplier on wages is incredibly painful, sure. But it's predictable. Mm. Aren't the invisible costs, like, say, an insurance policy suddenly voiding, are those the actual company killers?
Yeah, exactly. The wage multiplier is really just the entry fee. You're paying for urgency, for the scarcity of the labor, and for the physical risk the driver assumes by entering a highly volatile dispute zone.
Right.
But you also have hidden operational costs, like flying drivers in from out of state, housing them in hotels, paying agency premiums. But you hit the nail on the head regarding insurance. The insurance blind spot is where companies routinely hemorrhage risk.
How does simply changing the driver void a commercial fleet policy, though? Like, if the company owns the truck and the truck is insured, why does the underwriter care if the person behind the wheel is a full-time employee or a contractor from 3 states away?
Because underwriters do not just insure the metal of the truck. They insure the operational system that controls it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, commercial fleet policies are meticulously priced based on highly specific known variables. They look at the historical safety record of your full-time employees, the rigorousness of your specific internal training programs, and the familiarity your drivers have with their daily routes.
That makes total sense.
So when you suddenly introduce a fleet of temporary out-of-town contractors, the entire risk profile changes overnight. Your existing coverage just does not automatically extend to a completely different class of worker.
It's essentially like handing the keys of a rental car to a friend who isn't listed on the contract.
Yes.
The vehicle is the same, the road is the same, but if they hit a guardrail, the insurance company owes you absolutely nothing because the operational control changed hands.
Right, because the policy assumes standard operating conditions. And a labor dispute is, you know, the very definition of a non-standard condition.
Right.
Insurers will actively reassess your risk during a disruption, especially if accident rates spike. So if a company fails to validate their coverage before deployment, they might be operating under this false assumption of protection, only to face a catastrophic out-of-pocket liability after a major collision.
An unpredictable infinity cost, basically. A single severe accident without coverage could easily exceed the entire cost of the union's requested wage increases.
Exactly. Which is why the playbook mandates a pre-strike insurance audit. You must verify endorsements, check third-party liability clauses, and confirm that your specific contingency staffing plan is explicitly covered under your current premiums.
Because you do not want to negotiate with an insurance adjuster while a picket line is screaming outside your gates.
No, absolutely not.
Well, the underwriters are panicking because of the physical risk. Let's actually look at what's generating that risk on the asphalt. When these replacement drivers arrive, they are stepping into a highly volatile arena. And here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
A company is paying 3 times the standard rate for drivers who, by all accounts, initially performed significantly worse than the people they replaced.
Yeah, and management teams always struggle with this reality.
Yeah.
You're paying an exorbitant premium for labor, but early stage operational decline is practically a mathematical certainty.
Wow.
You're going to experience missed delivery windows, delayed shipments, terrible fuel inefficiency from wrong turns, and severe communication breakdowns with dispatch.
Well, I understand they lack the institutional knowledge. Like, the regular driver knows that the receiving dock at a specific warehouse is actually around back in the alley,
yeah,
and that the site manager, you know, won't sign for a delivery during their lunch hour. The replacement driver possesses literally none of that hyperlocal data. But wait, if they're performing worse operationally and they're stepping into an environment filled with picket line confrontations and potential vehicle obstruction, how on earth do you train someone to survive that in a compressed timeline? You can't exactly put a temporary contractor through a standard 3-week corporate onboarding program.
No, you can't rely on standard training at all. But just handing them a set of keys and hoping for the best,
yeah,
that basically guarantees a disaster.
Obviously.
So the playbook requires an accelerated onboarding model. It provides structure without demanding weeks of classroom time. It outlines a strict 4-step mechanism. The foundation is a pre-deployment digital briefing.
Let me push back on that, though. A PDF sent to an iPad does not prepare a human being for the psychological stress of a physical blockade, or like someone yelling at their windshield.
Well, the digital briefing isn't about teaching them how to drive. It's about establishing the legal rules of engagement.
Oh, I...
Yeah, it dictates precisely what to do if an exit is blocked, whom to call at dispatch, and the strict protocols for activating dash cameras.
Okay, so it's defensive.
Completely.
Yeah.
It's designed to prevent a panicked driver from making a split-second decision that escalates a tense confrontation into a multi-million-dollar physical injury lawsuit. The briefing basically sets the behavioral baseline.
Setting the baseline makes sense. So what follows the digital briefing?
Step 2 is an on-site operational walkthrough to familiarize them with the specific equipment.
Okay.
Step 3 involves shadow runs. That's where they navigate a supervised route before operating entirely independently. And the final step is strict compliance verification, just ensuring all Department of Transportation requirements are logged and active.
Even with those 4 steps, I mean, that's a fraction of the normal preparation. If they do not have the human familiarity with the routes or the safety protocols, what actually keeps the trucks on the road?
Technology. Technology serves as the ultimate bridge here. The playbook relies heavily on digital infrastructure to compensate for the lack of human institutional knowledge.
What kind of technology?
Organizations deploy GPS route optimization, digital checklists for mandatory pre-trip vehicle inspections, and real-time dispatch platforms.
So you are essentially using technology to instantly download a synthetic version of institutional knowledge directly into the cab of the truck.
Exactly. The software enforces the safety standards when human habits are absent. The technology dictates the safest path, ensures compliance tracking is standardized, and provides immediate incident reporting tools.
Right.
Without those digital guardrails actively guiding the replacement drivers, the temporary operational decline would spiral into a total system failure.
So the trucks are moving, the technology is guiding them, and the lawyers have cleared the hiring process. Let's look at the strategic aftermath of all this. Because having replacement drivers isn't just about surviving the first 48 hours of a strike, right? It's about what the entire company culture looks like next year.
Yeah, the echoes of these contingency decisions resonate long after the picket lines are dismantled.
Because the source material explicitly warns about the long-term labor relations consequences, hiring replacements, even when it's executed with perfect legal compliance, it shatters trust.
It really does.
Management faces strained relationships with union leadership, deeply reduced loyalty from the workforce once they eventually return, and severe internal cultural fragmentation.
And those consequences tie directly into the strategic calculation between utilizing temporary versus permanent replacements.
Right.
Utilizing temporary replacements is fundamentally a short-term continuity play. You keep the revenue flowing, preserve operational flexibility, and you attempt to avoid completely incinerating your relationship with the existing workforce. It carries a much lower legal risk profile and leaves the door open for a negotiated settlement.
Obviously, permanent replacements send a much more aggressive message.
Well, hiring permanent replacements signals a profound willingness to entirely restructure the organizational workforce.
Yep.
It's a long-term maneuver carrying significant legal peril, especially regarding those unfair labor practice classifications we discussed earlier.
Right, right.
And it guarantees massive enduring friction in labor relations. Most organizations intentionally default to temporary replacements precisely because the action is reversible.
But making either of those strategies work requires cross-departmental alignment. Like, the operations team can't just scream into a vacuum that they need more bodies.
No.
Legal must vet the compliance. Risk must validate the insurance underwriting. Human resources has to manage the accelerated onboarding. And communications must control the external messaging.
Yeah, and if those departments remain siloed, the contingency plan implodes under its own weight.
Obviously, RSS Inc. authored this playbook, so their ultimate conclusion is going to be, hey, do not attempt this yourself. Hire our firm. It is incredibly effective marketing.
Sure is.
But looking objectively at the sheer volume of bureaucratic tasks required, like running nationwide background checks, validating driver work histories, managing medical paperwork, pulling multi-state DMV reports, handling workers' compensation, aligning dispatch, maintaining legal compliance. I mean, is it even possible for a standard internal HR department to execute this under extreme pressure without a specialized partner?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, expecting an internal HR team to manage this is highly improbable.
Okay, why?
Consider the immense pressure an internal department faces the moment a strike commences. They are managing a massive internal crisis, facilitating ongoing union negotiations, answering terrified benefits questions from the striking workers, and desperately trying to maintain morale among the non-union staff.
But why can't a seasoned HR director just run background checks on the replacements like they do for normal new hires?
It's an issue of immense volume colliding with zero available time. Yes, a standard HR department might process, say, 5 background checks a week. During a strike, they suddenly need to process 50 Department of Transportation medical card verifications across multiple state lines in 48 hours, all while ensuring flawless legal compliance.
Wow, that's a huge jump.
It is. Asking them to simultaneously spin up a massive shadow logistics operation while fighting the internal fires is just a guaranteed recipe for failure.
So they simply lack the bandwidth and the specialized infrastructure.
Exactly. And this raises an important question. What is an organization actually purchasing when they retain a contingency firm like RSS Inc.?
Right.
They're not merely buying temporary labor. They are purchasing a pre-built parallel structure.
Parallel structure.
Yes. RSS arrives with a massive pre-qualified commercial driver network. Those drivers are already deeply vetted for licensing, medical compliance, and safety records.
So the firm handles the entire bureaucratic payload before the driver even steps onto the client's property.
That's right. They manage the disability insurance, the social security verifications, the multi-state DMV reporting, and they seamlessly integrate their personnel into the client's existing dispatch systems and safety protocols.
Wow.
Organizations that treat contingency staffing as a pre-established capability, something they built a relationship for long before the crisis materialized,
they
vastly outsurvive organizations that attempt to build the airplane while they're already falling out of the sky.
So what does this all mean? Stepping back to look at the entire deep dive, the central takeaway from this playbook is really undeniable. In high-stakes operational disruptions, survival is entirely dictated by preparation, not reaction.
Absolutely.
Deploying replacement drivers touches every single nerve of an organization. Mm-hmm. It demands flawless legal maneuvering, brutal financial calculations, intense frontline safety protocols, and massive bureaucratic infrastructure. It is never just a simple matter of putting a new driver in an empty seat.
No, it really serves as the ultimate stress test for an organization's entire architectural foundation.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we examine how that stress test is currently managed, it leaves us with a profound dynamic to consider regarding the future of the workforce.
How so?
Well, we highlighted how heavily these contingency operations rely on digital infrastructure, GPS route optimization, AI-assisted dispatching, digital compliance tracking. All of that is used to instantly compensate for a complete lack of human institutional knowledge.
Right. The digital crutch allows a total stranger to navigate a really complex route on day one.
Precisely. And as routing technology, artificial intelligence and dispatch, and digital compliance software continue to rapidly evolve, they're effectively lowering the barrier to entry for temporary, highly skilled labor.
Oh, wow.
Think about it. If an organization can seamlessly plug an entirely new driver into a vehicle and rely on software to perfectly guide them through complex, hyper-specialized routes without missing a beat, does the home field advantage of a deeply experienced unionized workforce begin to lose its historic leverage at the bargaining table?
That is a brilliant question to leave on. If the critical knowledge required to keep the supply chain moving lives inside the iPad on the dashboard rather than inside the driver's head, the entire power dynamic of labor relations completely shifts.
Exactly.
The operation looks incredibly simple from the outside, but underneath the surface, the legal frameworks, the insurance risks, and the evolving technology are just constantly shifting the ground beneath our feet. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking beneath the surface and keep questioning the hidden systems around you.